Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine podcast series. This is Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. This podcast features Deadman's Word by Russell D. McLean, which appeared in the December 2004 issue of AHMM. Russell is a resident of Dundee, Scotland, where many of his stories are set. He is the author of the novels The Good Son and The Lost Sister, which feature the private investigator Jay McNee. He's currently a columnist for the website of the International Thriller Writers Association, and he blogs at dosomedamage.com. This podcast was recorded at the 2010 VoucherCon in San Francisco, so please excuse the little background noise. And now here's Russell reading Deadman's Word.
Around 7 o'clock on Friday evening, Ali Dudman was escorted out the back doors of Tayside Police Headquarters and taken to an unmarked car. He was with two police constables who were escorting him to a local hotel. Ali Dudman was an important witness. Sure, he was a drug-dealing scumbag, but he was liable to bring down two big fish in the Dundee drug trade were he to appear as a witness in court. He wasn't testifying out the goodness of his own heart, of course. He was testifying to save his own arse, cut some kind of deal so they wouldn't treat him so harshly. The police considered the deal worth their while. They'd been after the Kennedy clan for a while. Robert Kennedy and his brother Jimmy were both in their mid-50s. They ostensibly ran a successful pub in the city centre. The Flophouse had been a Dundee institution for a few years and ran as a respectable business. No matter how often the police wanted to catch something going down there, they failed. Every time. The Kennedys weren't stupid. They knew how to play the game. Their father had, of course, been the same way. Organised crime is a family business. But now Ali Dudman had the smarts and the information to connect the Kennedys directly to drug shipments coming in and out of Dundee. He could link them to one of the biggest heroin trafficking scams in the country. No way the police were going to let this one go. At 6:45 that evening, Ali had begun getting cold feet. He'd been talking to DI George Lindsay, known informally among his colleagues as Curious George when he was out of earshot, due to his unnaturally simian features, and had begun to say how he was worried for his life. Curious, being a stubborn bastard, and hardly what you'd call a people person, told him to shut the hell up and be thankful he was getting the deal they were giving him. Warning bells should have rung, but Curious just wanted the stunted little shite out of the building, so he handed Ali over to the police escort with barely a word. At 7:20, one of the two escorts radioed in a garbled message. He sounded panic, and his transmission was cut off quickly. Nearby, beat officers dispatched to investigate the transmission. At 7:24, the two escorts were found unceremoniously crumpled on the pavement down Dudhope Street. They had moved under the light of a street lamp. One of them, the one who had radioed in, was still unconscious. His head was cut and bleeding. The other guy had suffered severe head trauma and lay unconscious beside his partner. 7:45, the escort car was found, abandoned, dumped in an alley with the keys still in the ignition. 8:03, DI Sandy Griggs walked out of a meeting with Curious George and called me from his mobile. "Sam," he said when I answered, "how are you doing?" He was trying to keep his voice light and cheery. "Fine," I said. Put my hand over the mouthpiece of the phone and mouthed Sandy's name across the table. Roz smiled at me, nodded her head. I knew I'd have to make it a quick call. "What's up?" "Ali Dudman," Sandy said. "Aye? You know him?" "We met a few times," Sandy said. "He was in police custody. Look, is this important? Because, you know, me and Roz were trying to have a nice wee intimate dinner, and it's a bit hard when..." "I'm sorry," said Sandy, cutting me off abruptly. "But aye, this is important." I apologised to Roz, took the call outside the restaurant. I watched her through the window, but she refused to look at me and ate her dinner slowly, with a deliberation that left me in no doubt I'd be in the doghouse when we got home. Sandy explained to me about Ali and his escape from police custody. "He's our best shot," he said, "at taking these bastards down, and now he's gone and pissed off. So what can I do about it?" "People hire your services to locate missing loved ones, right? Ali isn't exactly a loved one, but he's pretty damn important to me and a lot of other people." I sighed deeply. I'd promised Roz that this would be a special night. I'd been busy lately, case after case, and not to put too fine a point on it, she'd been getting more than a little narked with me. "So, can you not just find him yourself?" "You know as well as I do that the Kennedys are going to be looking for him," said Sandy. "And when they find him, we're going to find him dead and dumped in some council wheelie bin. Let's face facts here. The bureaucracy of Tayside Constabulary is going to tie up our search for some time. we are not going to get to him first. So, you bring in an outside contractor? If you want to look at it that way. And who's my client? Tayside Constabulary or Sandy Griggs? I looked at the window once more. Inside, Roz looked away. I waited for an answer. I know your rate, Sam. This is for me, because let's face facts here, pal, you're not exactly Mr. Popular with the local fuzz. I can't see the chief giving up part of this quarter's budget for your services. It was cold outside, and as I talked on the phone, I could see my breath in the air. Fine, I said, but don't you expect a bloody discount for this? He didn't laugh. I'll meet you at the Phoenix in half an hour. He hung up. I put the phone away and went back inside, took my seat across from Roz. She looked at her plate. What is it? She asked. Sandy. Every time, she said. Every damn time. I wish I had a 9-to-5 job, I said. Sometimes I really do. She looked up finally and smiled. But then you wouldn't be happy, babe, she said. And even though she was smiling, her brown eyes were tinged with a distant sadness. Sandy was tucked in a corner booth at the Phoenix, smoking a cigarette. He had 2 pints ready by the time I walked in. He'd already started drinking. His face was serious, his forehead crinkled slightly. Hey, I said, grabbing the seat across from him. I took the pint he'd got me and sipped at it. What kind of time frame we're talking about? Soon as possible, said Sandy. Odds are the Kennedys will be looking for him already. They've got contacts on the force. It's common knowledge. Either that, or they've developed some psychic voodoo mystical powers. Whatever, they seem to know everything that we do. They second-guess us, clean out their crap before we can come down on them. They'll know about Dudman, and they'll know he's missing. I sighed. So, where'd I start? Sandy reached inside the breast pocket of his jacket, pulled out a folded sheet of paper. He passed it over. I unfolded it. That's Dudman's mother's address and number, Sandy said, but also the pubs where he tends to drink. I doubt he'll be around, but maybe someone will know where to look. Also, you have his ex-wife there as well? How amicable was the divorce? So-so, said Sandy, far as these things go, anyhow. He took a deep drink of his pint. When he laid it back down on the table, he punctuated the move with a loud sigh. Says she hasn't talked to him since the divorce. Any children? None. So you gave me his mother's address. What about the father? Dead. Buried up at Balgay Cemetery. And known associates, I'm going to guess, are covered by crooked wee wankers like the Kennedys. Closest he has to a family, I'd imagine. So he's got nowhere to go? Probably not. And assuming he doesn't run back to the forgiving arms of Bobby and Jimmy. They're going to be looking the same place as we are, but they're not going to ask the questions so politely. I took a drink of my pint. It fell heavily down into my stomach, like a dead weight. I should get going, I said. The night is young. Nah, mate, said Sandy. This one's old. I grabbed the car, a flashy new BMW I got at a good price from a satisfied client, and headed out to Loch Ee, where Dudman's wife now lived in a comfortable semi with her new man. I didn't have much on him, but it was the ex-Mrs. Dudman I wanted to talk to anyway. The semi had a small garden out front, a pond with fish in it. I stopped on the path for a moment to look at them. They swam around under the surface, created patterns with their movements I doubt they were even aware of. The front door opened and a female voice said, "Who are you?" I looked up and saw a woman in her mid-40s standing on the front step. She wore a white dressing gown wrapped tight around her body. She was skeletally thin and her skin hung loosely about her frame. Her blue eyes were greying with age and sunken back in her skull. Her hair had been a vibrant blonde once, but now it was brittle straw. "Mrs. Jennifer Dudman?" I asked. "It's Fisher. Miss Fisher." "Oh, of course," I said. She'd taken back her maiden name after the divorce. Nice house. Guess, are you with the police? Already talked to some wanker called Lindsay. Bloody girl's name. D.I. Lindsay, I said. Something of a prat. I'm not a copper. I took out my wallet and walked up the path, handed her my card. I'm a private investigator. Didn't think we had those in Scotland. Well, there you go, I said, with a shrug. She looked me up and down. You look like a scruffy bag of tatties, she said. Watch those films in the afternoon, Ken, with that Humphrey Bogart and all. There's a private investigator's son. I smiled. Can I come in? No. It's important, I said. It's about Ali. Already told that DI, I haven't seen him in almost a year now. The divorce was amicable. Aye, doesn't mean I want to see the Torag again. Sure, I said, but I need to talk to him, Miss Fisher. And besides, this is definitely going to concern you. I'm not going to get rid of you, am I, son? I shook my head. Christ, she said. Come inside then, but wipe your bloody feet. No one trails mud around my house, you got that? Jennifer Fisher's front room was fairly small, free of clutter. The bookcase set into one wall was filled with a few videos and some pot plants. There were a couple of books there, as though in concession to the actual purpose of the cavity. They looked new, and I guess she wasn't much of a reader. She threw herself into a ragged brown armchair. Didn't bother inviting me to sit. I stood anyway. Like I said, I haven't seen him. She looked at me with hard eyes, as though she was challenging me to contradict her. In over a year, she said, emphasising each word in case I hadn't caught that information outside the house. Sure, I said. The two of you didn't talk, right? Bloody Torag, she said, condensing her feelings towards Ali in four forceful syllables. What do you think? I nodded. There was a small coffee table with an ashtray sitting in the middle of the room. Two cigarettes were crumpled in there. Made me wish I could spark up. I'd been trying to give up lately, Roz's idea, and now I was starting to see temptation round every corner. So, I haven't seen him, she emphasised once more. Okay, I said, but you know him better than most people. I mean, where else would he go if he needed a place to hide? She shrugged. Just about any bloody pub, she said. That'd be a good start. Or the bookies. You know he's in danger, I said. What, from the police? I shook my head. He was working with the police, I said. Maybe he was trying to turn his life around, I don't know, but he was working with them, and now that he's done a runner, the people who's helping the police to Nick are probably going to be after him. I walked to the bookshelf, scanned the unbroken spines, a few Grishams, Guinness Hit singles, the Atkins diet. They're not nice people, I said. They're pretty dangerous, actually. I kept my tone light and airy, like I did this kind of thing all the time, like it didn't matter to me one way or the other whether the Kennedy brothers got their hands in wee Ali Dudman. Too bad, said Jennifer Fisher. For Ali, I mean. But her tone trembled slightly. The front door opened. Jennifer, shouted a gruff man's voice. You in there? A burly ball of sweat came into the living room. He stopped and looked at me suspiciously, his small eyes narrowing. Who are you? Sam Bryson, I said. I'm a consultant with the police. Just here to ask Miss Fisher a few questions about her ex-husband. Can't you bloody people leave her alone? Thundered the ball of sweat. I tried not to look at him directly. He was a hard man in the worst sense of the word. Direct eye contact would be red flag to a bull, and I was no matador. I'm sorry to intrude, I said. Didn't mean to cause Miss Fisher here any trouble. So I think you should leave, he said. I glanced at Jennifer Fisher out of the corner of my eye. She was trembling, barely perceptible, but I could see it. It was a look I'd seen many times. She was petrified of this man. I wondered what would happen after I was gone. I walked past the big man and out the house, turned when I got to the gate and looked at the living room window. Jennifer Fisher knew something. Given time, she might even have told me, but now that the bruiser had walked back into her house and she'd just clammed up, it would give him just one more reason to beat the snot out of her. I called Sandy from my mobile. Hey, he said, any word? I think he's been to see his ex, I said, but she's not saying anything. Still sweet on him? I just don't think she wants her new man to find out, I said. Sandy was silent on the other end of the phone. I could sense his body tense, his fists close together. Knew the look he'd have in his eyes. His weakness, the one thing he couldn't handle in a calm and rational manner, was wife beaters and child batterers. To Sandy, they were the worst possible kind of criminal. It was personal. His own father had killed Sandy's mother. Sandy may even have killed his own father. It was a part of his life I'd never fully understood, a place he'd never let me into. All I knew was, it was an aspect of his police work he took seriously enough to bend more than a few rules in order to bring a conviction against anyone guilty of domestic abuse. The current advertising campaigns by the Scottish exec advocate a zero tolerance of domestic violence. Despite his deceptively skinny frame and thinning hair, Sandy could be the very embodiment of said zero tolerance. Okay, he said eventually. Try the mother. See if you can get anything from one of the bars. The Crone Claw, perhaps? Maybe Big Ian will know something. And what are you going to do? I might pop in, see if I can get Miss Fisher to be more cooperative. And her man? He's just going to have to lump it, said Sandy. Official police business and all. After I hung up, I looked back at the house. The curtains were closed. The house had swallowed Miss Fisher, and what had been a promising initial inquiry. There was no answer at Dudman's mother's house. She lived in a purpose-built council semi in a small cul-de-sac of identikit houses, separated only by the colour of their front doors. I persisted for a few minutes. The house next door opened. An old man in a dressing gown stepped onto the front step and looked at me. What do you want there? I need to speak to Mrs. Dudman. The old man laughed and scratched at his neck, like he had fleas. Won't get her, he said. Why not? Been gone 3 days. Gone. Dead, son, said the old man, and stopped laughing, his face hardened with the doomed wisdom of age. Dead. Did you know her well? Why do you want to know? I shrugged. I knew her son. Then get the hell out of here, the old man hissed. Just leave her alone. He went back inside and slammed the door. Told me all I needed to know about Dudman's relationship with his mother. Another dead end. Biggie and Mackie was behind the bar in the Crow and Claw when I walked in, wearing a horizontally striped polo shirt and black trousers. The middle age spread seemed to have grown since the last time we talked. I didn't want to bring it up, however. It'd only piss him off. Nevertheless, despite the advance of the years, he still looked more than capable of holding his own against any of the rough crowd who composed his regular clientele. Sammy, he said, no seen you around here in a while. I smiled, grabbed a seat at the bar. Big Ian pulled me a pint without asking. I figured one couldn't hurt too much. I was driving, but sometimes you have to make the sacrifices. I've not been in the area, I told him. No one's around these days, he said, and sighed. Looked at the bar, people congregating around the tables, leaning into their small groups as though they're afraid someone was listening. Well, no one worth bothering about anyway. All the old crowd have gone. They either got respectable or they got into trouble. And what about Ali Dudman? What am I now, your wee snitch? I smiled. Ali's the snitch, or hadn't you heard? He was in trouble with the Kennedys right enough, said Ian. Mind you, Ali's the type of ball bag he'd get in trouble with just about anyone. I need to find him, Ian, I said. He put the pint down on the bar. Some of the head broke off, drifting down the smooth edges of the glass. How would I know where he is? Ali was a regular, I said. Still, you're known for your loyalty. Even to wee ball bags who went and joined the coppers, he said, pointedly. I'm not a cop these days. Just as bad. You work for him. I do favours for friends sometimes, I said. Some of those friends are in the law enforcement business. He chuckled at that. Ali's life's in danger, I said. I'm going to help him. Aye, and what about your friend? He's looking to help too. All we want is to help Ali. He was in here about half an hour ago, said Ian. Asked me for help. And what did you say? I said I couldn't help someone as messed up as him. You couldn't help a wee ball bag like that, you mean? Aye, that's about it. Look, Sammy boy, I don't know what this is all about, Ken, but Ali looked in a bad way. Where would he go if you couldn't help him? It's a few places. I nodded, took a deep drink of the pint. He couldn't go home, Ian said. No, if he was in trouble with the Kennedys, so he'd need money and clothes and all that if he wanted to get out. I'd say he'd go to see Omar. Omar? I can't exactly see them getting along. Omar doesn't care about that kind of crap, Sammy. All he cares about is making sure his family are taken care of. All he cares about is where the next bushel of money's coming from. I nodded. I didn't want to go and see Omar, but Ian was right. If Ali wanted money, clothes, and a quick, quiet escape from the city, he'd go and talk to Omar. It was 10 to 11 by the time I reached Omar's pad. He operated at a high-rise in one of the poorer areas of the city. One of those men who had a finger in almost every pie, but was careful enough not to get any filling stuck under his nails. When I knocked at his door, his brother answered. Yafit took one look at me and shook his head. I knew what he meant. Omar didn't like me. We'd only met a few times, but those few times had been enough for Omar to know that we'd never be friends. When he finally came to the door, he was dressed in a sharp grey suit. Last time we'd talked, he was clean-shaven, but now he'd grown a beard. It was flecked with grey. I guess he must have been approaching 50. He looked at me like I was some kind of insect, finally said, I know why you're here. You do? Raise your arms. I did so. He gestured for his brother to come out into the hallway. Yafit patted me down, took my cell phone out of my pocket and turned it off. You'll get that back when you leave, said Omar. I nodded. Yafit stood up straight and nodded to his brother. Everything was okay, I was clean. So I suppose you can come in. We walked through to the living room, a widescreen TV hooked up to a DVD player showing Pulp Fiction, the pictured pause of Uma Thurman and John Travolta dancing to Chuck Berry. Nice setup, I said, nodding to the TV. Omar grinned. I know a guy, he said. Then his face became stony once more. He gestured to the sofa. I took a seat. Omar remained standing. You know why I'm here? Yes, he said. Ali Dudman. I waited. You do favours for the police? Ali was doing a favour for the police? Don't waste my time, I said. I'll waste as much of it as I want, Omar said. Mr. Bryson, you do realise that you and I are not exactly on friendly terms. I smiled. Sure, but these days there's not a lot of people with whom I am on friendly terms. After all, on a few occasions you have inconvenienced me. I shook my head. You mean those illegal immigrants? The guys you faked passport for? The criminals you sneaked into this country? They had regrettable past, Mr. Bryson, but none of us are angels. In any case, it was just an unhappy coincidence, considering I was following up on a young girl who disappeared with one of your associates. Not only did you disrupt the business of people like myself, but you insist on horning into a burgeoning love affair. She was 13, and burdened by archaic laws that forbade her to express the love she felt for my friend. I snorted, tried not to let myself erupt into laughter. He was trying to ruffle me on purpose. Any excuse to throw me out of his pad, arse first. But what is the use in talking over old times, Mr. Bryson? Ali was supposed to help us bring down the Kennedys, I said. He was supposed to give evidence tomorrow. If he doesn't show, that's all our evidence down the crapper. Omar shrugged. Don't pretend you don't care, I said. I've caused you a few minor headaches, but the Kennedys are a full-blown migraine. I know you've been wanting to expand your business opportunities, Omar, but everywhere you turn, people are so scared of the Kennedys and the power they wield, so they fob you off with some excuse, or they back down after one of the boy's friends says a word in their ear. Omar kept his poker face up, but I knew I was getting to him. After a while in my line of work, you develop an extra sense about people, like you can see inside their heads, even when they're giving nothing away. It's not infallible, but the odds are usually pretty good, and someone like Omar I thought I knew well enough to read accurately. Finally, he said, I gave Ali a ticket down to Manchester. Some friends were to meet him down there, give him a head start, keep an eye on him, make sure he paid the amount upon which we agreed. When does the train leave? Omar looked at the clock on the wall behind me, smiled. You've got 10 minutes, Mr. Bryson. I hope you're a good driver. As I pulled into the car park, I was thankful that Dundee is such an odd little city. Dundee rush hour lasts from about 5 o'clock until maybe 6, or at the latest 6:30. After that, taxis aside, the city is easy to navigate. And the police seemed to be sleeping on the job, which meant I got down to the station with minutes to spare. I jumped out of the BMW, already running as I threw the door shut behind me and sprinted into the station. At this time of night it was empty. The newsstand was almost dead, the shutters down, the newspaper racks emptied. The platforms and departure lounge are down a long, steep flight of stairs. I stumbled down, managing to keep my footing by miracle of grace. There was only one other person in the lounge, a tramp with a green sleeping bag. He opened his eyes when he heard my footsteps clattering off the linoleum floor, and then he decided I wasn't a threat, lay back down on the bench he'd taken for a bed. My heart jumped in my chest as I realised I might be late. British Rail had a knack for their trains running early when it was least convenient. The rest of the time, of course, they'd be late by several hours, but whenever you had a deadline to worry about, oh, they'd be running early. I looked at the departure arrival board. Only one train scheduled to arrive in the next few minutes. It was heading to Glasgow, but I guessed Ali was going to change there, getting an overnighter down to Manchester. Under my feet, the ground rumbled. The train was getting close. I ran out the door to my left and onto Platform 3. Looking up the tracks, I could see the signs for Platform 4, where the train was supposed to make its stop. Already, the train's lights were in plain view. There was a solitary figure standing near the edge of the platform. I ran towards him, fishing my mobile out of my pocket, hitting Sandy's number. He answered fast. I said, train station, and hung up. Ali looked at me as I ran up to him, like a startled rabbit. His eyes widened and he took a step away from me, his legs buckling. Ali, I said, I don't want to hurt you. That bloody DI sent you, didn't he? Aye, Ali, he did. Ali straightened a little, looking wary. I have to go, he said. No, Ali, you're going to stay here. You're going to testify against the Kennedys. Get to hell, Ali said, laughing as he did so. The laugh was nervous, the kind of laugh you have when there's a knife edge resting against your jugular. This is too dangerous for me, man. I made a mistake, all right? Ali, your testament's important. I don't care. I never thought it through properly, man. You didn't mess with the Kennedys, like. They're the royal family, man. They got connections everywhere. Like, they know where you sleep, where you eat, and never had to make it through the testimony. You were under police protection. Aye, like that makes a bloody difference. The train pulled up beside us. The doors opened. I'm getting out of here, said Ali, stepping across the gap. I lunged forward, grabbed him by the collar. He made a little strangled sound as his shirt tightened round his throat. He fell backward. I stepped aside and he landed arse first on the platform. He tried to stand, but I kicked my foot down his chest. Passengers on the train looked out the windows, gawping as I applied the pressure to Ali's chest. No one did anything, of course. It's a peculiar trait of people that they can just stand by and idly watch as someone gets their arse handed to them on a plate. I kept Ali there on the ground with my heel digging into his chest until the plane pulled away from the platform again. Once the train was gone, I lifted my foot. Ali stood up cautiously, tugged at his shirt to straighten it out, muttered, "Arsewipe." Name-calling wasn't going to do him any good. "You're going to be a good citizen, Ali," I said. "Believe me, it's a good feeling." "I am king of the world," said Ali. "Christ, get 2 days, I'll be a hole in the ground." "You won't. They can protect you, Ali. They know what they're doing." He laughed. "Aye, sure," he said. "Well, come on then, if we're going." As we walked down the platform, he chuckled and said, "Dead wanker walking." "Cheer up," I said. "They're going to give you a nice hotel." Sirens began to blare in the near distance. "They're coming for me," he said. "Aye, that's right. They're going to be a little pissed off, right?" "Maybe a little. I heard two of their officers, Ken." He took in a deep breath. "Maybe it's not just the Kennedys I have to worry about." "This isn't LA," I said. "You're not Rodney King." He looked at me strangely. "Who?" he said. I let it go. When we were about to head back into the station itself, out of the cold night air, someone came out of the departure lounge bumping into us. I registered he was a big guy, didn't think much of it. "Sorry, mate," he grumbled, kept going. "Arsehole," muttered Ali. I started to walk him inside. "Hey, Dudman," shouted the big guy. When Ali turned, I knew something was wrong. I went to pushing him out of the way as the big guy threw back the raincoat he was wearing and pulled out a shotgun. I watched this happen in slow motion, pushing Ali as hard as I could, trying to get him on the ground, out of the way. I looked at the big guy's face. Now that he was standing under the yellow lights that illuminated the platform, I recognised him. It was the guy I'd seen at Jennifer Fisher's place. Ali stumbled towards the tracks, hoping somehow he could leap down there and get out of the way, but he was too slow, and I was too slow. So hard to move, to think straight, to make the right decisions. A moment's hesitation, the big guy pulled the trigger. The explosion was so loud I felt like my head was going to explode. But it was Ali's instead. The side of his head ripped outward as he spun with the force of the impact, flesh flapping loosely. He smashed to the ground, his body rolled with the momentum, and he tipped over the edge of the platform down onto the tracks. The big guy smiled, walked towards me, shotgun held high. I kept my ground, my eyes locked with his, my face as still as I could manage. I was giving nothing away. "I know you," he said. "We've met. You're a tit, you know that. At least I'm a left tit, no right tit," I said, which in retrospect was not a cunning plan. Never a good move to piss off the guy holding a shotgun. "The police are coming," I said, trying to play for time. "Guess I'd better be quick," he replied. The sirens had gone silent now. They were here, probably coming down the stairs. I just had to keep him talking for a moment more. But it wasn't going to happen. He knew as well as I did that this was no time for him to be dicking around. His finger tightened on the trigger. So I faked right, and then shifted my weight, diving left, pushing the glass doors inwards to the departure lounge. I fell through the door and hit the ground with my shoulder, rolling, ignoring the pain. There was the shotgun blast, the shattering of glass. I rolled onto my back, couldn't keep going. The momentum died a death, and I lay on the floor. There was footsteps and shouting. Someone was kneeling beside me. "Sam, you okay?" It was Sandy. "Bastard with the shotgun," I said, my voice rasping with effort. "Shot Dudman." Sandy helped me to my feet. We ran outside. Two PCs were pursuing the big guy with his shotgun down towards platform 4. He was running with his back to them. Sandy said, "He's going to run out of platform." He was quick for a guy with such a bulky frame. He stopped suddenly, turned on his heels and raised his gun. Sandy shouted to the officers, "Get down!" They hit the deck as the big guy fired off 2 shots. He stumbled as each blast recoiled. His feet hit the edge of the track. He tried to shift his weight and staggered at the edge of the platform, then fell backwards, his arms flailing wildly. The shotgun went over with him. There was a final explosion, and then silence. Sandy let loose a lungful of air. He ran a hand through his hair. He looked at me. "You did your best," he said. "Not good enough," I said. "The Kendys are going to walk, aren't they?" "Aye," said Sandy. "Without Dudman, everything we have goes to hell." I swore. "I went to have a wee word with Jennifer Fisher," Sandy said. "You're right, that son of a bitch there nearly pummeled her to death." He gritted his teeth. "I ever get my hands on him alone," he said. "He's closer than you think. See that big bone bastard down the tracks," I said. "That's your man." Sandy nodded, walked to the lip of the platform, looked down at the big man on the tracks below. He wasn't moving. His head lay at an awkward angle. I hope he is dead, Sandy said. That'd be the easy way out of all this. I got back to my place at 3:30. I'd spent a few hours talking to Sandy and then Curious George, who said they'd have found Ali Dudman eventually and it was my fault the situation went spinning out of control. I nodded and answered his questions. Curious George and I have never been friends. I don't care much for his opinion. If he wanted to think I was the cause of Dudman's death, I didn't care. The truth was, Dudman would probably still be dead whether I'd become involved or not. Sometimes situations have their own way of developing, and it doesn't matter what you do. Things will work out the way they want to. When I got back home, my body ached all over. The stress of being shot at and of seeing Ali Dudman's face being ripped apart by a 12-gauge shotgun had finally begun to manifest. I looked in the kitchen cupboard, saw a half-finished bottle of Jack Daniels waiting there for me. I thought about it for a moment, and then decided that maybe I deserved some of the good stuff for a change. I reached further back into the drinks cupboard, pulled out a bottle of Glenmorangie. Okay, still wasn't five-star living, but felt like more of a luxury. A reward for surviving another day. I heard footsteps behind me, turned around and saw Roz standing in the kitchen door. Her hair was messed up from being slept on. She shook her head and took a step towards me. Reaching out with her left hand, she took the bottle away from me and put it on the breakfast bar. Not tonight, she said. Then took my hand and led me to the bedroom.
Thank you, Russell.
That's okay. Thank you for asking me to do it.
Great. Your first novel, The Good Son, has been shortlisted for Seamus Award for the Best First Private Eye Novel.
Yes, right? Best First Private Eye Novel, yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, about the book, yes, absolutely. The Good Son is a private eye novel, obviously, because it was up for the Seamus, set again in Dundee, like the short stories that I wrote for Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. It's a different detective, of course. It's a few years later than a lot of those stories. And there's a small scene at the beginning where he does inherit the offices of Sam Bryson from the man himself, who's never mentioned by name, but it is him. So there's a little connection back to Hitchcock's. The whole thing starts when a farmer finds his brother, who he hasn't seen for several decades, hanging in the local woods. So he has to hire an investigator, of course, to look into this. And our man, who's called Jay McNee, that's J as in the initial J. We never know his first name. He starts to look into the life of the dead brother and uncover some connections to the London underworld, to the London gang world, which bring a pair of killers up to the streets of Dundee, and it all goes very, very badly wrong. I can't say much more than that in it, but it's done very well, as you say, up for the Seamus. Of course, the winner of the Seamus last night was Brad Parks, who is wonderfully deserving, but you know, I have to say that now. No, it's worth being nominated, certainly, and to lose out to a book like that was very good. So.
Well, it's great to be shortlisted in such great company.
It was a great, and the evening was great as well.
Yeah. So now you've followed up with the second book.
Yes, The Lost Sister, it's called. You may notice a theme. which again is with Jay McNee comes back. There's a lot of stuff we learn about in the first book. He's lost his fiancée in a car accident. He's trying to deal with the guilt of that because it may or may not have been his fault. So that's kind of dealt with in the first book. And this book kind of sees him trying to rebuild a life at the same time as he's continuing his own business and getting involved with a 15-year-old girl who's... Is she 15 or 14? Oh dear, that's really bad. I can't remember my own book. But a young girl who's disappeared in the city of Dundee and has connections to some figures we met in the first novel. And it's a different style of book. I like to kind of change up the kind of investigations he does, but it'll definitely it's hopefully as good, if not better. I would hope it's better, in fact. And it's been doing nicely in the UK. So.
Oh, great. And do you have a third book in the works?
There is a third book currently being worked on, but it's a standalone, actually. I have five books planned for McNee if anyone will let me do them. I'm currently working on a standalone, but we'll wait and see what happens there, because everything's yet to be signed and sealed and delivered. I won't say anything more than that. I don't want to jinx it. But it should be very exciting.
Now, and you grew up in Dundee.
I didn't grow up in Dundee. No, I grew up in Fife, which is across the water from Dundee. So that's very country living, across in Fife. In 1998, I went to university in Dundee. So I've been there about 12 years now. So I feel like I've seen the city as an outsider's perspective as well. It's easier to write in it as well. It's got a fascinating history as a city as well. It was an industrial city that lost a lot of its industry, and then it's got new money coming in. So that makes it great fun to write about, because you've got all those tensions. that hopefully come through in the novels and hopefully did in the short stories with Hitchcock's as well.
And stories certainly have a sense of place.
Yeah. Whether the Dundee Tourist Board agree with me, I'm not sure.
That was Russell D. McLean reading his story, Dead Men's Word, from the December 2004 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, which is published by Dell Magazines. This recording was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo. Look for Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine at your newsstand. Electronic editions of the magazine are also available for all e-readers. You can learn more about us online at themysteryplace.com, and you can follow us on Facebook.